From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we learn how an increasing reliance on social media is influencing political campaigning and the world of activism. Then we learn about Milwaukee's Forest Home Cemetery, which used to be considered the city's first park.
People were faced with death because they just didn't live as long. And so for people to go and visit their families, memorialize them, this is where they went. But there were also people that came here just to have picnics and just to enjoy the beauty of the surroundings.
Plus, we learn about the history of tarot cards, and one practitioner explains what card readings mean to him.
Getting out of one's default mindset and widening your perspective about what has happened in the past, what is happening in the present, and what could potentially happen in the future.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. COVID-19 has changed political campaigning. Large rallies meant to drum up support aren't happening in the same way. And the Democratic National Convention was a mostly virtual event. This means the already cavernous echo chamber of social media has the potential to become even more influential. Amber Wachowski is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University and the director of the Marquette Democracy Lab. She's working with Parrish Papadla, professor of marketing at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and co-director of the Northwestern Data Science Institute. Wachowski and Papadla are coordinating on a project that's tracking the major issues engaging both candidates and voters in the 2020 election. They spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about how more screen time and less FaceTime could impact this year's election.
You know, there's a lot of concern about the integrity of these technologies in the sense of kind of who's speaking when we are encountering information on social media. Questions about how misinformation might kind of propagate and spread across the internet. We're now seeing in the headlines here discussions about conspiracy theories. This is certainly not anything that is new to American politics. You know, the sort of discussions of conspiracies, you know, go back to the, you know, to the early 1800s. But the question about how our social media is transforming our electoral environment, I see it in a couple different ways. One is we have definitely seen in the context of social movements, the ability for activists to kind of use these technologies to spread their message, to kind of mobilize their supporters. Some have called it this sort of organizing without organization. Whether we're thinking about these hashtag campaigns like Black Lives Matter or Me Too, and the ways in which they've really come up through the grassroots. At the same time, there's concern about the people who use social media, especially those who were tweeting, in this case on Twitter, about politics. They tend to come from the more ideological extreme of the electorate. And there's this concern that folks are not really engaging in any sort of democratic deliberation, but they're just in their echo chambers. And that is hardening their perspectives, their views, in a way making them less tolerant of those, in this case, on the other side of the political aisle. And so in some sense, it might kind of undermine our democracy in some sense if we don't have a shared basis of fact and experience that we're all part of. In 2016, we had a lot of attention to whether it was bots and kind of who's directing these bots and trying to spread information on the internet, the role of Russia, for example, and trying to meddle in our electoral system. And so, you know, following this out, you know, in many ways, it's kind of like campaign advertising where government tries to regulate, right, the spending of money and what you get is almost like a whack-a-mole kind of problem, right, where you have us address one particular issue and then something else emerges. And it kind of feels like we're in this space right now with social media, questions, you know, going on not just about bots, but now questions about deepfakes and the ability for people to manipulate video, you know, and audio content, and not having an ability to really kind of check the truthfulness. Like, what is truth in this environment?
I want to bring in one more point. We were concerned about this issue right from the start of the project. The fact that everything that we are able to monitor and collect on social media may not be genuine. There could be bots talking. There could be misinformation that's being spread. So we had to take a stand on what we would do about that, right? The consensus was that while on the one hand, bots are not genuine, on the other hand, to the extent that the large social media companies are not able to continuously spot them, stop them, and eliminate them from the discussion, bots are definitely influencing people's thinking. So to the extent that they are a part of the process, regardless of whether you like it or not, it's important to collect what they are saying and understand how they're affecting what people think, right? So we took a decision that we're going to collect everything that's coming out on social media and analyze that and track it. On the one hand, I would, based on everything that is happening in terms of the regulatory processes, the hearings in Congress, and just the increased discussion of the issue in the media, that there is more sensitization to the issue of security, which would then mean that there are steps being taken to keep the discussions more genuine. That said, it's a losing battle. The moment that a social media company comes up with an approach to stop a bot, someone else comes out with a new bot, right? And that has to be stopped. So I think it's a battle that's an ongoing thing. All I think we can say is that the efforts into controlling fakes and things that are not true or genuine have increased, but I don't think we have come to a point where they can be stopped or they are stopped.
Since the normalization of using these tools in politics, what are some key things or changes that have stood out to you in the political sphere?
Right. Well, I mean, clearly it has become a much more of a, what I would call a digital battle for minds than a traditional battle for minds, right? In the traditional process, candidates would go door to door, talk to people, meet people, understand what they're saying, tell them what they think they about the issues and so on. That's the process, right? Now, with the digitization of the discourse and with the echo chamber that Amber was referring to, I think the one side effect has been the hardening of views that would be consistent with what I already believe. If I believe something, social media are feeding me what they think I want to see, that's making me much more hardened in my opinions. And so I think it had the effect of dividing us as a society, right? And politicians obviously are catering to that. So they know that people are going to want to hear what they want to hear, and there are tools to do that. And so politicians are also reaching out to people that they know will support them and telling them what they want to hear. So I don't know what the overall effect of this on our democracy is. And so that's, I think, the effect of the digitization.
Yeah, I really do think it's really a case of contrasts and some contradictions as well. You definitely see evidence here of the democratizing force of social media. And I'll just give the example of online discussions about racial justice. So earlier this year, the Electorator Project, we gathered data on how people are talking about racial justice issues on Twitter. We looked at how the candidates are talking about these issues. And then we just looked at what you might think of as like the mainstream news coverage of this issue. So here looking at the big newspaper, national newspapers, as well as cable news. And we're able to kind of track this out over time to see kind of who's leading whom, who's driving the conversations here. And it used to be, you know, the classic studies from the 1970s about agenda setting would say, wow, it's really our political elites. It's the power of the media to kind of shape which issues voters are thinking about, right? They're kind of driving the train here. But in this particular case, what we're observing is that these discussions on social media are not being reactive. They're helping to drive that conversation, right? We saw this kind of playing out throughout the summer, just even thinking about the ways in which these mass protests took place across the country. On the flip side, you know, we also see evidence, and to speak to the point about people are in their echo chambers and the ways in which confirmation bias works to kind of keep us deeply polarized. There's also evidence that it's helping to feed what we call affective polarization, the idea that I'm attracted to a party, a political party, less because of the things that that party stands for, but more because I can't stand the other party. If you're not having a campaign environment that it's really kind of the broad discussion and vetting of these issues, you know, what does that say about the quality of our democracy? And so, you know, I guess I'm somewhat inspired by efforts of people to always wanting to do better, finding ways to kind of take the best of social media, but can we find ways to actually facilitate our, you know, kind of the flourishing of democracy? Are there ways that we should be designing our algorithms, right, so that I'm not just getting fed a steady diet of things that already sit with my predispositions, but might actually increase my exposure to different points of view? I mean, for me, as a political scientist who's interested in that sort of deliberative democracy, for me, that's where I would love to see social media go. But I don't think we're there yet.
Now that many people are working in their homes and large gatherings have moved to digital spaces, we're relying on the internet more than ever. How has that impacted our ability to truly understand the current political climate?
Change in how we work, I think, has had and will continue to have major significance for our culture and society in the following sense, right? I'm working at my computer day in and day out. And who am I interacting with? I'm interacting with the media. I'm interacting with my friends through social media. What that then means is that I'm only interacting with things and those that I'm comfortable with and that I identify with. I'm no longer exposed to a diversity of views which would happen when I went to work. Regardless of whether I like it or not, I would meet Joe Smith at the water cooler, and if Joe has a different point of view and starts talking to me, I'm not going to ask him to shut up and walk off, right? I'm going to listen to that. So I'm picking up that a different point of view as I go into the world. Here, I'm forced to avoid that, or rather, maybe I prefer to avoid that, and I'm listening to essentially what I want to listen to. So I think it's going to have an enormous impact on the rifts in our society. And it's going to ripple through politics and culture and a lot of other things. So I think it's not something that is a one-time thing that's happening to us. I think it's going to have very long-term consequences.
You know, Purush, your point there about our conversations at the water cooler being kind of some of the few opportunities we have to engage political differences. You know, there's some work that's now almost 20 years old that really finds that, yeah, our shared work environments, our jobs are kind of where we're most likely to encounter people who hold differences in political views. I mean, that was changing a bit with just how polarized our country has become. Many Americans have just stopped talking about politics in general, right? They just know it's uncomfortable and they're just going to avoid it. But the point about how with all of us working and not having those sort of serendipitous, you know, the random conversations about issues and what that might mean to our polity, you know, I hadn't really, I guess I'm still in it and thinking that maybe we're going to get on the other side and that like life somehow returns to normal. But I think as this continues on, we are going to see more and more employers seeing that it actually makes business sense for them to actually have their workers working remotely.
How effective do you think activism is in the digital space, such as online petitions and calls for change on social media?
I think it's enormously effective because going back to the whole idea of democratization, I think that's one area where the democratization of individual voices is obvious, right? Whereas earlier, even if I believed in something or even if I wanted to be active about something, it would have been an extremely heavy lift for me to go out and build a movement around that idea. Now, I can jump online, and if I have enough friends online that believe in what I'm saying, and they have friends, and they have friends, the message is going to just ripple through, right? Clearly, the message has to be something that people would identify with. But if it is, building that broad base for the message is much, much faster and less in effort compared to the days of pre-social media. And of course, that brings with it its own dangers, right? I mean, regardless of whether the idea has merit or not, whether what its implications for society are, good and bad ideas both can build up momentum. I think it's a double-edged sword, but the sword is here.
Yeah, on this question about online activism, you know, I think we have some cases that kind of at least should give us a little pause about how effective relying on online activism alone will be. And I'll just bring up Occupy Wall Street, I think, is an example here, right, where we saw it was, you know, Adbusters kind of putting it out on Twitter, you know, Occupy Wall Street, and it spread, right, like wildfire. And you had all of those people, protesting and occupying space, not just in New York, but in many other cities, in Oakland, in Madison, Wisconsin, and, you know, all across the country. And it seemed like, oh, maybe we're at a tipping point. But I think it also gives us pause in the sense that while campaigns can really get going off the ground and can really go viral, kind of sustaining them in a way that these movements can actually influence politics, right, and kind of work through and kind of continue and have a more long-lasting change, you still need the organizational infrastructure. It can't just be organizing without organization. And so I'll give, like, Black Lives Matter, I think, is a good example of where you've got this kind of hybrid setup, right, where you've got these hashtags that really are able to leverage social media and to spread the message and to kind of get it in the public consciousness. But you also have chapters and groups kind of sprouting up in all sorts of cities and kind of taking on, like, the hard politics, whether it's, like, increasing participation in local elections or trying to get new DAs elected, you know, across the country. You're seeing that they're not abandoning the sort of old style of politics or old style of organizing. It's just one more tool in the toolkit. And that's the way I think that we should think about online activism. It's one more tool in the toolkit. But if that's all you're relying on, I just don't think that's going to be quite effective.
Moving forward, what are your concerns about the reliance on the internet and social media tools during this election year?
I have one. I've been telling my students, I'm teaching a class on campaigns and elections, that given the new reality in which many Americans will be casting their ballots by mail, right, voting absentee, it's likely, if this is a really close race, that we won't know who the winner is on election night. But we have the internet and the ability where people are reporting out the election returns and trying to make sense of them. I'm really curious about how the major news outlets are going to be covering this election as the returns come in. But I guess I am, you know, concerned about efforts to sort of undermine the integrity of the elections or to kind of cast doubt, I should say, on the integrity of the elections, to kind of say, well, you know, it looked like so-and-so was up, you know, at 10 o'clock or at 11 o'clock at night. But now 2 days later, we found more, you know, we've tabulated those absentee ballots and now the other candidate's up. And so my fear is that while that is a perfectly legitimate, right, playing out of this election in these times, that on election night, there could be, right, the sort of confusion, chaos, the sowing of discord, and this sort of undermining the integrity, you know, or the perceived integrity of the elections. So it's something that I think, I'm only one, you know, teacher here telling my students, you know, counseling patience. But I do think that this is going to be really important this election year because these are really trying times. It's uncertain, the great kind of uncertainty in which the election will play out, and the fact that millions of Americans will be voting by mail for the very first time. likely means that it's not going to feel like a normal election night, and that should be okay. We should have some patience and let those votes come in and be counted.
Once again, I want to go back to this, although I don't want to sound like a broken record. I think it's a double-edged sword, the internet, right? And the good edge of that sword is that I think it's one way for more and more members of the society to get engaged in the process, right? You're able to actually get more insight, more information on what's going on and the issues are. Clearly, there are questions about whether all that information is valid, but more people are engaged. And it could also become a tool to mobilize more interest in going out and voting, right? Because you can exhort people that it's important to go out and vote. So that's the positive side of the sword. The negative side of the sword that I really worry about is, in addition to all the issues that we talked about the echo chamber idea, about, you know, interacting with only people and opinions that you already have, I'm really concerned about interference and information coming from outside the country, right? I'm worried about, given how global the reach of the internet and social media is, right? There's no way that we can fully stop or even control the flow of information from beyond our borders, be it for good or for bad. So my concern is, what does that do to our democracy? It's we, the people here, who should be judging the issues here, who should be deciding on what is important to us. But now there's a massive unknown and unseen set of voices coming from outside our borders. How do we deal with that? That's my concern.
Amber Wachowski is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University, and Parrish Papadla is a professor of marketing at UW-Milwaukee. They spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel. Coming up next, we learn about one of Milwaukee's hidden gems, Forest Home Cemetery. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. As we continue to look for things to do outdoors during the pandemic, one of Milwaukee's first parks, Forest Home Cemetery, hopes to become a place for safe and socially distant leisure. The idea of going to a cemetery for recreation may seem odd today, but at its peak popularity, Forest Home would attract thousands of visitors on a single day to picnic or walk around the gardens, fountains, and monuments. Forest Home Assistant Executive Director Sarah Tomlin is relatively new to the field, having started the job in May after working at the Milwaukee Art Museum. But she says that, like the museum, the cemetery is a nonprofit and a place full of beauty and history for people to explore. To find out more about Forest Home Cemetery, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke to Tomlin, who explains how the cemetery was first created.
Forest Home, since 1850, has been a nonprofit, and it's been open to people from all backgrounds and all denominations since the beginning. It was created by a group of leaders from St. Paul's Episcopal Church, and they saw a need for having a cemetery that would be welcoming to everyone, and also one that was pretty large. Up until then, there were only about six smallish cemeteries in Milwaukee. Milwaukee was maybe 20,000 people, and we were growing really rapidly. And those other six cemeteries were either small municipal cemeteries that weren't cared for very well, or there were three other ones that were for specific denominations like Jewish and Catholic and Lutheran. It first started out, it was purchased, there were 72 acres that were purchased. And then there was also a group of about 50 prominent business people that chipped in to buy plots that then helped for the operating costs to start up the cemetery. At that time, it was located about 2 miles from downtown. It was not in the city limits. And it's now, I mean, it's in Milwaukee now, but it's in the Lincoln Park area. And we're not very far from downtown still. So in the beginning, they hired Increase Lapham, and he was the city surveyor, and they had him create the design for the cemetery. He was obviously very influenced by the rural cemetery movement, and Mount Auburn in Massachusetts is a really good example of that. It's, you know, really capitalizing on the rolling hills and not having straight roads, curving roads, and really bringing out the natural aspects of the scenery. So he created the cemetery, is deeply influenced by the garden cemetery movement. And once it was created, and it really showcased nature and had this picturesqueness about it and created a serene space, people came, and they came to bury their dead, and they came to enjoy the space as a park, because it really was also one of the first parks. Up until then, there was just a few little squares in Milwaukee that served as parks, and there really wasn't a space to escape and have that kind of serene, beautiful place that got you out of the city. Then this is also a place where people could come and visit their dead. I mean, more often people were faced with death because they just didn't live as long. And so for people to go and visit their families, memorialize them, this is where they went. But there were also people that came here just to have picnics and just to enjoy the beauty of the surroundings. It became so popular that by like 1888, there's a quote from a gatekeeper that said he thought that probably 8,000 people came on one single Sunday to come picnic and enjoy the grounds. I mean, that was back when there was a little over 100,000 acres. Now we have 200,000. It's definitely a space where you can be here and not see very many other people, which is really a nice place to escape to.
And cemeteries today, I think, are places we only think about when either physically passing them on the road in our cars or when we have to go to one for a service. And I think people view death a lot differently today than back in its founding. As you mentioned, people just were around death a lot more. And with Forest Home serving as Milwaukee's park, what features did it have during its peak popularity? Because it's much more than just maybe a maintenance building and lots of land for people to bury.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, there are Victorian gardens, and there still are. And we also have fountains, and we have a pond. Our trees are so old and so beautiful. We have thousands of trees of different species. Some are champion trees, which are trees that have been designated as champions for Wisconsin that have a certain height and width and age to them. So we definitely are forest home because we are home to a forest of trees, and it provides a beautiful canopy. But also the monuments. Our monuments are amazing, and people really took a lot of time to create the monuments and actually have some of them commissioned by artists to memorialize their dead. We are, of course, known for the beer barons that we have buried here. We have most of the beer barons, and some of the biggest monuments are Schlitz and Pabst and Blatt's. The largest mausoleums in the state of Wisconsin and possibly the Midwest is the Blatt's Monument. So, you know, there's plenty to see here as far as monuments go. And just the history of who's buried here. We have 26 mayors, including Byron Kilbourne. We have founders of Milwaukee like A.O. Smith and Harley Davidson, Allen Bradley, the founders of Milwaukee that really made Milwaukee what it is today. And Milwaukee grew very quickly. So it's because of all these businesses and the jobs that were available here and those business people like Harnischweger, they're all here. And this is the original site for those families. And then we also have Black leaders like Ezekiel Gillespie. He went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court in 1866 to get the right to vote for Black people recognized. We have more contemporary people who are very important, like Dickie Chappelle. She was a photojournalist and a war correspondent, and the first female correspondent to be killed in Vietnam. She covered the World War II and Vietnam. And we have like over 1,000 Civil War veterans that are buried here also. So we have a lot of history. I could go on forever with the actual history of
so many acres filled with it. And you were, of course, mentioning a few of the highlights. Have you come across and have any favorite grave sites or monuments that have stuck with you as you've been getting acquainted with who's there and as you're exploring the grounds?
Yeah, I mean, what I really realize is that we are sort of an outdoor museum. We're an outdoor history museum. We're an outdoor art museum. For me, with my background, I'm one of our most famous and beautiful monuments is the T.A. Chapman Monument, and it as a bronze angel that was created by Daniel Chester French for T.A. Chapman. And T.A. Chapman was the owner of a department store downtown that kind of closed in the 70s. That monument, Daniel Chester French is also created the Lincoln Memorial, and he was very sought after as a sculptor at the time, and it's just beautiful. We also have another headstone that was also commissioned by the widow of Gertrude Ninnemacher Schuchart, and she passed away. She actually committed suicide, and her husband commissioned Paul Manship, and that sculptor is the one that did Prometheus in Rockefeller Center. And that's actually one of my favorites. It's made out of concrete, so it's not holding up very well, but it's quite beautiful. It's an outline of a woman. It's very Art Deco, and it has the zodiac sort of around the edges of it. And that's over in section 33. It's really very, quite nice.
So as you mentioned, you're a park, an outdoor art museum. At one time, I think there were some animals there wandering the grounds. It was kind of a zoo for people. What do you think contributed to the way people see cemeteries now versus a place for not just reflection, but also recreation that Forest Home once served as?
Yeah, that's a good point, because it was originally created so that people who are living could enjoy it. And I think now cemeteries are a different place, and it's probably because of a couple different things with death. People died more often, so you were encountering more often, and you're going to funeral services, and you knew more people who had died. And so to go and pay respects to them was something that became a family activity. Memorial Day was a big deal. I think that now when families are farther away from each other, they don't all live in the same city like they used to. That's probably less likely that you're going to go and visit a relative and go and visit their gravesite if you don't live there. And, you know, also we just don't have as many people dying all the time. It's not something you encounter and you don't think about. When people ask me how our business is doing during the pandemic, that's been kind of an interesting question, because we do have probably a little more business, but it's really on the side of people thinking about death at this time. And I think that's led them to actually pick up the phone and call us to make some plans for the future and where they're going to be finally interred. We also, you know, we really want to encourage people to come to the cemetery and explore it like people did back in the day before there were other parks. I know that has been a great relief for me during the pandemic, is to go out and be in nature and go to the parks. And I know, because I live near a park and would go to it all the time anyway, that it's gotten really busy at the parks lately. So if you want a place that you can come that's quiet, that has reflection, that might be a distressor for you, the cemetery really gives that to people. It's once you get inside these gates, I think you realize how special it is. And you can also, it's amazing how busy and crazy it is outside the gates here. It's a busy neighborhood. And once you get in here, it's very quiet. The canopy of trees is beautiful. Our monuments are wonderful, and you can find beautiful and interesting monuments everywhere. You don't even have to have a map. We do have guided tours that you can download from our website, or if our office is open, we do have some of them printed. And you can even pick up a copy of our most recent book that talks about the history of Forest Home. But there is definitely a great feeling to the cemetery, and it's the peacefulness, it's the picturesqueness, and we really want people to come and enjoy it if they're looking for an escape right now.
As you mentioned, it's a busy neighborhood around the cemetery, and obviously that wasn't the case on its founding. Obviously, it was, as you said, outside of the city, and as cities grow, you know, the residential areas kind of enclose Forest Home a bit. But wouldn't you say we don't necessarily need a connection to, say, a family member being buried there, but simply the fact that this is tied to the very history of our city, that it's probably a hidden treasure that people don't really know about?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I mean, we do have people from the neighborhood who have been coming and taking advantage of the grounds. We have our friend George, who rides his bike through the cemetery every day. We encourage bike riding and running and walking. You can bring dogs if they're leashed, and just approach everything like you would if you were in a park. Be respectful, don't litter, don't make a lot of noise, obviously. There are burials going on occasionally on the grounds, though we have, you know, 200 acres, so you might not encounter one. And on Sundays, we don't do any burials, so that's a good time to come visit if you don't want to encroach on anything like that.
Well, I appreciate you giving us a little bit of insight, and I know our conversations will definitely continue to the many aspects there are surrounding Forest Home. But for today, Sarah, thanks so much for sharing some of its history with us.
Oh, great. Thank you very much for having me. This has been great.
Sarah Tomlin is the Assistant Executive Director of Forest Home Cemetery in Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. We'll take a short break, then we'll look at the history and modern interpretations of the tarot. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Tarot cards have an interesting reputation. Their link to the occult can make them seem taboo or sacrilegious. Some people connect them to hustlers or crooks looking to make a quick buck. But those who believe in it often see the cards as a way to reconnect with their feelings and aspirations. As COVID-19 continues to sicken people around the world, our collective future can feel more uncertain than it once did. Tarot practitioner Lawrence Ross believes these cards can provide a window into the possible and directions when we feel most directionless. Ross was the guest curator for an exhibit at Woodland Pattern Book Center about historical and regional interpretations of the tarot. We spoke back in March when the exhibit first opened. Lawrence Ross, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
So, this, when I looked it up, was a little convoluted, but what are the origins of tarot?
That is a huge question. It's also a highly disputed question.
I know.
So there's no definitive answer that everyone is in agreement for. We know that the idea of the cards exists from sort of the Renaissance time, basically. The oldest cards that still exist in some capacity are Italian. Although there's nothing like a complete deck. The oldest, mostly complete, four cards are missing, mostly complete tarot deck is from 1650, Marseille-style deck by Jean Noblet.
Yeah, when I looked it up, it seemed like some people said it came from the 1400s. There were some who speculated it was even older than that. But when it came to what we consider tarot now, the kind of fortune-telling game of sorts that we do now, it seemed like those roots were in the 1700s.
That's pretty accurate. I think that as far as the divination aspect of tarot is concerned, right around the end of the 1600s, beginning of 1700s is probably accurate. When people think of tarot now, I do think that people think of fortune-telling, though I think that many actual practitioners of tarot now would not describe it as fortune-telling exactly. There are certainly some who use it as a method of divination and would think of it as telling the future or fortune-telling, although I think most tarot readers that I have encountered anyway consider it something a bit more having to do with the present than the future.
Let's unpack that a little. When you're saying divination, what do you mean by that?
also a complicated word, but I think that in terms of, I'm just going to speak about tarot since there are many forms of divination. Yeah. I think in terms of tarot and the way in which, I'll answer this even in a more sort of subjective way. The way I perceive of divination with the tarot is that it is a way of getting out of one's default mindset and widening your perspective about what has happened in the past, what is happening in the present, and what could potentially happen in the future. And using a sort of system of archetypes that are quite old, parables, metaphors, stories, narratives that have resonated over centuries to provide some type of illumination about one's circumstances that is difficult to do, like, just in your head.
So lay this out for me. Say I go to you and I'm looking for a tarot reading. How does what you're saying play out inside of that reading?
During a tarot reading, when I'm giving a tarot reading, the basics is whoever I am giving the reading for, often called like the querent. Some tarot readers have the querent ask a question. Some tarot readers just have the querent just sort of have cards drawn and sort of listen and have things unfold. The way in which I learned tarot is to read tarot narratively. So it's taking the archetypes, taking the spread of whatever cards are drawn, and sort of figuring out how those images, how those scenes, how those archetypes fit into a larger narrative for the moment.
With that idea of archetypes, I think people who may not be familiar with actually getting a tarot reading will be familiar with the cards. They're very iconic, and there's all of these symbols that they seem to show up in every deck. I think of ones like the Sun or the Fool, the Magician. What are these archetypes in the context of tarot? What do they represent?
Some people consider them stages of life in a very linear fashion. Some people consider them stages of life in a more cyclical fashion. But I think that they're all states of being, or sometimes emotions, or sometimes situational, both conflicts as well as pleasantries that one experiences over and over and over again. I like to think of them as sort of touchstones in the common human condition. So I think the reason why a tarot reading resonates so much is because the source material itself is just made up of the raw material of living. So when you're referencing a specific archetype like the Fool, which is about newness, curiosity, naivete, those are all experiences and mindsets that we've experienced at one time. So if the archetype of the Fool, for example, comes up in a reading, oftentimes I find it to be an invitation to be more curious, to be more open, to embrace the positive aspects of being naive, which is you are ready to absorb what's around you, what surrounds you.
As you alluded to earlier, there's a number of different spreads, and it seems as though each of them has a different kind of meaning for whoever is getting the reading.
The most classic tarot spread is the Celtic cross, which is 10 cards. That's sort of the standard. In addition to the different spreads meaning something different for the person having their cards read, practitioners also use the spreads very differently and oftentimes design their own. I think many experienced tarot readers have their preferred spreads and oftentimes have riffed on something that they've been taught, that they've read. There's certainly plenty of people who read with the very traditional Celtic cross method, or a very common three-card spread is a past, present, future card. That's a very, very common spread.
Well, and that gets to something, you know, the idea that people really personalize this for whomever is doing the reading, perhaps for who is getting the reading. Something that comes up in a lot of the research is different decks. And it seems like having a different deck imbues different meaning. What is the significance of different types of tarot cards?
Complicated question again. I would say that there are sort of three dominant styles of tarot cards. There is the Marseille tradition, which is the oldest, and then there is the Rider-Waite-Smith sort of model, which is, roughly speaking, 100 years old, and the Thoth model, which is only slightly newer than that. Those are the three dominant models. In the popular sort of like cultural awareness of tarot, Pamela Coleman Smith is the artist and the tarot that most people think of when they think of the Fool, the Magician, etc.
For someone who is doing the reading or getting a reading, does it matter which cards you are using?
For the practitioner, I think the practitioner chooses the imagery that resonates the most. And I guess to go back to your original question of like, does it matter? The interpretations or the meanings or the quote-unquote definitions of the cards are based in numerology, they're based in astrology, and while there are variants between those three dominant styles, there's also, I would say there's more crossover than there are differences. So knowledge of one lends itself to knowledge of another. There are some significant differences between the styles, but I think if you're looking at it from a global perspective, they are fairly consistent. I think when it comes to which deck are you going to read with or which deck do you want to have read for you, it's the imagery that resonates really, I think, is the advice that I've heard most frequently given. That's also how I chose the first deck that I worked with extensively, was the imagery.
What do you think people misunderstand about tarot reading?
I think one of the most common misperceptions is that tarot reading is necessarily about the future and deterministic, and it's that you're learning what will happen. I think that's a very common misunderstanding of tarot. I think that by solely relegating tarot to fortune telling we then associate with, you know, a sort of like carnival performance, possibly even the area of like trickster, or like putting on some type of ruse, or like that it's a game. And tarot was originally a game. I should just clarify that. It was originally a card game before it was used for divination. But I think when people are hesitant about tarot, it's about some type of fear of like not knowing exactly what's going on or how it's used, or what the implications are, or if it butts up in a way that is incongruent with one's religious beliefs, I think is also another fear that people have, which might also be a misconception, because there are plenty of tarot readers who are also quite Christian, and a lot of the imagery in traditional tarot decks is derived from Christian imagery.
So you're the curator of an exhibit all about tarot. What does this exhibit explore?
As the curator, I wanted to put together an exhibition that explored regional representations of tarot imagery. In other words, artists who were taking where they live or their own cultural backgrounds and using the traditional tarot imagery as a lens to express their regional identity and cultural identity.
And it seems like, just from an outside perspective, that there are a lot more people who seem to be engaging with tarot. I feel like I see all the time, you know, tarot decks advertised in bookstores, in a variety of places. Why do you think there's been this resurgence of popularity?
I think there's been a resurgence of popularity not only with tarot, but with the occult in general, with astrology, with the idea of signs and astral charts. And I think that especially people that are working in creative fields are very drawn to the tarot now. And I think a lot of writers in particular are drawn to the tarot now because the tarot can be so narrative, that you can sort of see stories unfold, that you see these images that pop up in poems, in novels, in short stories. And the act of reading the tarot is very similar to the act of critically reading a text, so that when you're reading a tarot spread, if one has a background in literature and criticism, the way in which one makes sense of the images in front of you is very much the same as you make sense of a dense text like Melville's Moby Dick, which is that you're looking for repetition, you're looking for patterns, you're looking for archetypes like whiteness or fire that you have seen in the past, and how that appears in a way that's expected with the archetype, and how that also is colored slightly differently given the text that's right in front of you. Whether that text is, again, a novel, or that text is the spread that's in front of you of cards. To go back to your original question, I read an article probably a year ago that was trying to answer this question, and I'm going to reference that article for a moment. I'm sorry, I don't remember who wrote it or where I read it. But it was sort of suggesting that in a time of sort of political uncertainty, economic uncertainty, global uncertainty, that where we might have relied more upon what we knew with certainty in the past to look forward, that that seems like a less reliable source. And I think that astrology, I think that tarot allows a more creative way to consider the possibilities of the future, and also possibilities of the future that aren't necessarily as grim as if you, you know, sit in your house and read the news and listen to the news for 12 hours. I think that there's an element of optimism and hope ultimately that underpin astrology and tarot that make navigating both the day-to-day and sort of longer-term plans, I guess, a bit more in your control, which is really what the opposite, I think, most people think of fortune-telling is. It's not so much this is what's going to happen, but I think astrology and tarot can allow the person who is getting a reading or reading their chart to think of the opportunities that seem closed off but that aren't really. So it actually allows more pathways to open than it does telling you which path you are going to go down.
All right. Well, Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lawrence Ross is a writer and a guest curator for Woodland Pattern Book Center in Milwaukee's River West neighborhood. We spoke back in March, and you can still see the exhibit on their website. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.